Welcome to Hot Flashes and Cold Topics, a podcast for women in midlife and beyond. At Hot Flashes and Cold Topics, we talk about anything and everything to do with midlife. My name is Bridget.
And I'm Colleen.
And today we have a wonderful guest. We always have wonderful guests, but today we have Marcia Mason. We are so excited to talk to her. We were so excited to talk to her. She is lovely.
She's lovely. Yeah, we both say the same thing.
She's lovely. She is lovely. She is funny. She's just smart, constantly learning something new, not afraid to take on new things that are not easy. It's not like an easy thing to take on. Learning all about organic farming. This is before organic farming was like, you know,
yeah, this is the late 80s.
Yeah, she's like a pioneer in organic farming and race car driving, which you will hear about that. She has been, she has had 4 Academy Award nominations, and I think she should have won, definitely for the Goodbye Girl. Come on,
people. Oh my gosh,
and yes. And she has won 2 Golden Globes. She has won 2 Golden Globes, and she has been nominated for Emmys for Frasier. And she was on The Middle. She was on Grace and Frankie. She's been on so many different shows. I can't even think of all the shows that she's been on. She's also in Broadway, and not only as an actor in Broadway, she's also directing, and she's also doing a lot of streaming. So she's got some really great streaming things coming up. And Colleen, anything else you want to add to that?
I'm still just glowing from the conversation, yes. Honestly. Yeah. I'm on a Marcia Mason high because just such a wonderful woman and lives such a positive life story. And, you know, she has had struggles. She has had challenges. But the way she pivots and kind of her journey in life is so inspirational. I got so much from that conversation that honestly, it's just swimming upstream as one of her new shows goes.
Yes,
she just swims. She just keeps swimming upstream. That's what she does.
Yes.
She'll talk about that and what attracted her to acting and the story of her life and what we as midlife women can really learn from it, because she is a woman who is not afraid to learn new things, to take on challenges, put herself in a race car and learn how to ride it. And what a joy.
And pass men up driving that car, you know.
Exactly.
Yes.
And we have to say, you know, we have been privileged on the show to interview so many amazing women in midlife and beyond. We like to call them primetime women. And they all just seem to have that positive forward attitude, like keep moving, keep going. And I'm going to just absorb every ounce of this life that I can. And she's just another example of that. So what a great conversation. We hope you enjoy it. We're going to let her do the talking. And here is Marcia Mason. Welcome back to Hot Flashes and Cool Topics, guys. Today is a very special day on the show. We have Marcia Mason, 4-time Academy Award nominee, 2-time Golden Globe winner. So many accolades that we could list. And we'll talk about so many of them. Welcome to the show, Marcia.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, I'm thrilled to be here. I love your title.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
We get that a lot. It's
very Yes.
Well, thank you for coming on. We know you're very busy. I kind of wanted to start off the conversation with what you're doing now, because in the pandemic, honestly, a lot of times in your life, you have pivoted in wonderful ways that just kind of represent the strength of women. But recently, during the pandemic, you have pivoted more into doing streaming. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I out of a desperation to want to be creative in this, you know, difficult period, and also sheer terror that one's career is over and will never come back, I just sort of launched myself into streaming, and I did a 2-character play with Brian Cox for the Bucks County Playhouse called Dear Liar, and had such a great time. Mark Brokaw directed it, And then I've been working with the Keene Company, which is a small New York City company off Broadway. And I'm going to be doing a radio play tonight called Sorry Wrong Number through their platform, which should be really fun and interesting, hopefully. And I just, you know, just started to sort of throw myself into it, and now found myself directing a full-length play, Jericho, by Jack Canfora, with five actors, all in different places, recorded on StreamYard, but then using individual cameras. So I've been overwhelmed with editing notes for the editor, and also learning a whole new language. I would say two-shot. It's a two-shot, and the tech director would say, oh, side-by-side. So I had to learn a whole new thing. And I've been playing with the configurations of what one can do in a limited way. It can't really be, you know, like a film. But anyway, so it's been very, very exciting. And they're going to be streaming the play Jericho mid-March through the New Normal Rep, which is a whole new group of people.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of people. So it's really wonderful. Terrific actors and a lovely play.
Wow. And I mean, did you have enough time? Like how... I'm just sitting here in my mind. I was going to say, because this is just a whole new world.
Oh,
like
it's
streaming and there's nothing like you could refer to on how to do this.
No, you're absolutely right. It was like, and we were all in it together. We had never done it. Nobody had done it yet, myself included, at least in terms of full-length play, you know, with that many actors. They're all in different places. They all had separate technical kits, but everybody's learning curve was very different. We had some very savvy people and some, like me, who were coming at it totally in a virginal way. And, you know, you had moments when, you know, earbuds would drop out. And you're recording and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. But we ultimately got it done and we bounced off walls, but we got it done. So.
Oh, wow. Well, it's amazing. And you can tell that people that are in this industry are creative because they are coming up with all these ways to keep moving and keep going. And we're thankful. Those of us that aren't as creative are very thankful for that because we, you know, it's been great that we have things to watch and things to occupy our time because of the creative people like you. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
So one of the shows that you have been on recently is Grace and Frankie. And I wanted to find out, have they started filming again or are they still?
Oh, no, they haven't. I was supposed to go out March 15th or something like that to shoot for the last season. And wound up here in Connecticut and, you know, and California in general, and especially LA, has had a really rough time with the virus. So I don't know what's going to happen.
You've worked on a lot of ensemble casts like Frasier and The Good Wife. But what is Grace and Frankie like? Because it's like-minded women all in the same room, creative and kind of pinging off people.
Yes. And it's a wonderful set, first of all. It's a great set because Jane and Lily sort of set the tone and they're just terrific, both of them. And they, in some ways, they become those two characters. So Jane, I mean, I never know when we've stopped shooting sometimes in terms of how Jane refers to Lily or Lily refers to Jane, but they're just, they're darling and they're sweet and they're very giving. They make you feel very comfortable coming on to the set, which sometimes can be a bit awkward for somebody who just bops in once in a while. It's like they have a kind of rhythm and you have to kind of fit into it, but they make it extremely welcoming. Frasier was like that also. I remember David Hyde Pierce telling me that sometimes it's the hardest thing to have a guest a star come in because they're in a sort of rhythm and the person isn't in that flow. So it can be kind of awkward. But my was fortunate in both instances that it was just a really terrific role and a terrific set. And Marta Kaufman and the writers are all very, very hip and terrific, really terrific.
We had talked to Patricia Heaton a few months ago, and we were just talking about different things. And I think she brought up saying, I can't believe how you're not really that much older than Patricia Heaton. And they had you playing her mother. And
I had her when I was 15.
You couldn't have been her mother. Yeah. But you did a great job. You know, I loved that show, and it was fabulous. It is just amazing how they just ages and how they just play off and put people in different ages all the time. And we've talked, but you're somebody that seems to keep getting, you know, work all the time, or, you know, you're constantly, it seems like you've been working even since your like breakout days, from the beginning.
Also because of the theater. I started out as a theater actor, and I just love the theater. So I never gave it up, even when, you know, the business changed in the 80s and there wasn't as much happening for me on film. I grabbed whatever I was offered, you know, because I wanted to stay involved. But I also stayed very much involved in the theater always. So as a matter of fact, I'm supposed to do a play that I did last year, or no, 2019, about 3 North Dublin women from the same family called Little Gem. And I think we're going to try and put it on StreamYard for the Irish Rep.
Good.
Yeah.
Oh, good. That would be
that character.
Because for those 3 characters, you had a lot of monologue to memorize.
Oh, huge. It was. Mm-hmm. It was like memorizing a novel. Because I had 5 long monologues. They were 2 and 3 pages, single spaced. So it was, and in a North Dublin accent, which for life of me, I can't remember. So I'm going to have to go back and learn it all.
That's what you did. Yeah. Goodness. So yes. do you prefer one over the other? Do you prefer film or TV over theater? Do you care? Do you like them both?
I do like them both. I think I feel stronger a bit about the theater, but only because the theater can most of the time offer me more interesting roles than what is kind of available for me now in terms of the business. And that's just always the way it's been, you know, even in feature films. It was hard to find good roles for women. Men generally dominated the scene. But that's changed now with the Me Too movement, but also just a kind of coming of age of the rest of the country in terms of women's stories. So I feel very positive about the future. I just want to stay as healthy as possible and work until I drop.
Oh, that is great.
We interviewed an author of Successful Aging, and he talked, Daniel Levitin, and he talks about work until you drop, never retire. And if you do retire, go right into volunteering. Keep yourself active, and that will help keep you healthy. So
I think, I do. I think that's, and part of the reason I did Little Gem in 2019 was I challenged myself to memorize all that, because if you don't exercise your brain, then you do lose the cells, you know? So I think that's really important. I had a friend, Blair Brown, who used to just memorize sonnets and poems just to keep herself going if she wasn't working.
That is great advice. That's great advice for now. I mean, especially now where, you know, you're trying to get out, you can't do what you normally did.
To take it back to kind of when you started, when did you discover a love for acting or theater?
I was in high school. I think it was my freshman year of high school at Nerinx Hall in St. Louis. And at that time, the arts were supported, you know, in the schools and considered part of a good education. So we had a one-act acting club, kind of, and we did competitions with other states in the Midwest. I remember traveling on a train and going to, you know, Nebraska or something for wow. some festival, one-act festival. But I got a chance to, they were going to do a musical or a big kind of show called Babes in Toyland. And so it was for the whole school and the community out in Webster Groves. And they just assigned me a Jack in the Box. I had to pop up at a certain moment. And so I popped up, you know, in a costume and everything. And there was this row of little kids, you know, they were like 5 and 6. And all of them went, oh, like that. And I was totally hooked from that.
Oh, wow.
I knew that's really what I wanted to do. And I enlisted my father, because it was a girls' school. And so I enlisted my father to play the wizard. So yeah, that's when I said it. And from that moment on, I was bitten, and it never stopped.
Wow. I mean, that I love stories like that, though, because it's just incredible that you have that passion. So and it comes through in your work. You know, and the passion, you know, you've been nominated, you won Golden Globes. So does that put pressure on you? Like, here you come through, you were pretty young, you know, get nominated. And is that pressure for your next role? Like, oh my gosh, I got nominated. Now I have to knock it out of the park this time. Or is that a pressure?
I think probably maybe for some people, especially now in the business where it's even tougher than it was. I think for me, it was a bit more relaxed back in the 70s. You could get more films made for a smaller amount of money than what it costs now. And we had time to rehearse and all of that stuff. But for me, the toughest part was to have that sort of overnight sensation. I was just doing rep at ACT in San Francisco and got two movies in the same year. They came out in the same year. And I got nominated for Cinderella Liberty. And I was not prepared for that. Mm-hmm. And then when I also had a whirlwind romance, you know, with Neil Simon, we got married while we were doing the show on Broadway, The Good Doctor, and The Goodbye Girl just sent it into the stratosphere. And I was scared. I was mm-hmm. not prepared to handle the success of it exactly. It scared me. Mm-hmm. And when I did Cinderella Liberty, also, you know, then I was offered only, you know, prostitute roles or gypsy mm-hmm. or, you know, something. So it was kind of, I felt much more comfortable and wanted to just go back to ACT and be part of an ensemble. That's been, that was a hard adjustment.
I bet that was, yeah.
When mm-hmm. you, so you have this, you call it whirlwind, we call it 3 weeks. You get married. My understanding is your first husband was pretty quick too. Like when you know, you know.
Yes, that's true. I met him, I think, in September, and we were married in February. But we lived in the same brownstone, you know, in separate apartments. I met him the first day I got to New York. So, yeah. And we made friends through it all. He was close to Neil. And when I built the farm out in New Mexico, he and his partner came and they built a house on it. And he was sort of eyes and ears when I would go off working to maintain the farm. And then he passed away out there.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. He was very happy. He loved New Mexico. He was from New Mexico. So
okay.
Yeah, it was great.
When you got married to Neil Simon and, you know, The Goodbye Girl comes out and it's like you said, you're kind of in this whirlwind. What is it like to be married to someone who's directing a lot of your films as well? Was it difficult to kind of put that hat on and then take it off at the end of the day and go home?
Strangely enough, it kind of wasn't. I think partially because, or maybe mostly because, the two of us had an enormous respect for each other's talent. I always was very strong about memorizing exactly the lines as they were written, even in not so good plays. But I had enormous respect for him. And also, he was a charming and extremely funny, wonderful man in private. He was very shy in public. And very quiet, but personally, we had a great time together. So that kind of just bled into and onto the set, and consequently, we just had a really, really good working relationship. And I know that some couples can't work together; it just sends them in the wrong direction. But for Neil and I, we had a terrific professional relationship in all the films that we did. And it enabled us to raise his two daughters, and they became my daughters, and I love them to death to this day. In fact, my oldest, Ellen, lives just about 3 minutes from me. She
moved
to be on the East Coast and stuff. So you know, it worked out okay. It's just, it's hard, though, you know, if one person really wants you there all the time, and they're used to having somebody there all the time, and you want to go off and maybe challenge yourself, it puts a strain on a relationship. And eventually, we agreed that it just wasn't working for him. He wanted to have somebody at home and somebody who didn't have a career. So mm-hmm. we had 10 great years together. And but even after we separated and divorced, I wound up doing Prisoner of Second Avenue, his play, in London at the Royal Haymarket with Richard Dreyfuss. And he came and we had a great time together, and he loved it. And so it was really good.
Oh, I mean, that is really amazing. But, you know, you put it, you know, that's how it works out.
One of the stories that I thought was so interesting about The Goodbye Girl when I was doing some research was that originally he had written it to be kind of the second chapter of the show. Like, once he became Richard Dreyfuss' character became a star and how he handled family, what made him change it and back it up to the story of them actually meeting and going from there?
The script that was the genesis, really, for The Goodbye Girl was a movie that he wrote called Bogart Slept Here. And it was roughly based on Dustin Hoffman's breakthrough kind of moment in his career, where he was doing an off-Broadway show and somebody, a famous director, Mike Nichols, came along and offered him The Graduate. And Neil started from that point of view about wanting to write about success. And then they went into pre-production and the whole, nine yards and everything, and we even shot a little. And then Neil realized that there was something majorly wrong with the material. And it was basically, I remember him saying, you know, people aren't interested in successful people. They're always interested in the underdog. So consequently, we shut down and regrouped. And Neil went away and said, give me 4 weeks or whatever it was. And he came up with The Goodbye Girl. So The Goodbye Girl ends sort of where Bogart Slept Here had started, if you would.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole scene, for example, you know, when he's doing Richard III and everything. So that's how that all wound up taking place. But in those days, you know, you had the wherewithal and the studio power and stuff, and the finances weren't excruciating. I mean, I think the picture maybe, I don't even know. I think it was probably around 20,000. You know, it was so little. It was just little to shoot. You could afford to do that. We rehearsed for a good, I think, 8 days, 9 days on the set with Quinn Cummings and Richard and myself doing the Goodbye Girl script. So, and it was also, Richard came in and I didn't know him. He didn't know me, but we just had this immediate chemistry, and we have it to this day. And so it just kind of came through the camera and really worked. I mean, we didn't know it was going to be a successful picture.
As it was, yeah.
Not at all. We didn't know it was going to last as long as it has.
I watched it. Go ahead. Yeah.
It stays pretty current.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem too dated, I gather. So
I thought it was so funny that they acted like you were old when you were 33. I was like, she's only 33. What? She's not 100, you know?
I know.
Yeah, I was like, oh, it's my crazy. Gosh. But it was so good. It was so good, the whole thing. And it was so, it just, you and Richard Dreyfuss, the chemistry, you know, was so good.
That was amazing.
And I can see why, you were nominated, you know, and you should have won. So.
Thank you. That's it.
So you do all these movies is kind of a decade of a whirlwind. You know, it's hard enough for women to get those roles, and you were getting a lot of them, and you were knocking them out of the park. And then you said, you know what? I'm going to up and move to New Mexico and start an organic farm. What was your mindset in doing that? And kudos to you for even having the courage at that time to say, I'm going to put my, you know, not my career completely gone, but just on hold for a second and focus on myself. Can you talk about how that came about?
Well, it was in the late 80s. The business was had changed remarkably. It had moved on and was very youth-oriented. And so there were not very many roles that were interesting to do. And I was now single. I built a house out in California in the Palisades, and I really tried to build a life, a single life out there, and it just didn't feel right. And I had one of those kinds of moments where I just thought to myself, I've done this occasionally, well, rarely, but I have done it about 3 or 4 times, where I just think, what the heck? I'm going to throw the pieces of my life up in the air like a kaleidoscope and see, you know, what new pattern can come down. And meanwhile, my ex-husband and his partner were thinking about building a second house out in New Mexico. And I said, well, maybe I'll tag along. And Neil and I had a house in New Mexico, and I thought about keeping it during the divorce, but then we decided to sell it, and I was fine with that. So, but I went back out there, and there's something about that country that's really very special. I can't quite explain it, but I know why it draws people. And I was just kind of like kind of existing. And my friend Shirley McLean said, oh, I'm moving to New Mexico, and I saw this piece of property just the other day, and it'd be perfect for you. She said, oh, yes, absolutely. You have to go look at it. So I said, okay. So I go out and I look at this property around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's all on the Rio Chama, and it's just raw land. It's grazing land, and there's some horses on it, and it just was so beautiful. So I thought, what the heck? So I bought 250 acres and I called Shirley up and I said, okay, so when your ultra-terrestrials come, you can invite them, because she bought the mountain behind me. So I said, you can welcome them and I'll feed them down here. So that's how that happened. And then I was working and I took my time trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I never intended it to be a working farm, but, you know, first I thought I'll just be a good steward. So I wound up learning about permaculture and biodynamics, and I went to soil fertility conferences in the dead of winter in Minnesota. And stuff, you know, when I wasn't either racing or working, you know, in television or whatever. So eventually it was just, I heard some woman was growing chamomile in Arizona, and I thought, well, if a woman can grow chamomile in Arizona, I guess I could grow some stuff here, because I always believed in alternative medicine. So I got organic seeds, and I, you know, asked the universe for a grower, and I got this fabulous Bolivian man who just came up to the farm, to the land one day, and things like that happened out there all the time. If you get really clear and you just ask the question that you need the answer to, within 48 hours, something shows up that leads you to the next phase. And then before I knew it, I was a working farmer doing certified organic medicinal herbs, learning biodynamic farming techniques. And then I was going off to prisoner of Second Avenue. I thought, I'm going to be in a completely different environment. My hands are a mess. These theaters are 400 years old. So I went to a master herbalist. I said, look, this is everything I'm growing. Come and look at it and see what you think. And then I asked him for a salve and for a tincture for my throat. And so we began to work on these formulas for myself, really. And then the next thing I knew is I thought, well, maybe we'll sell them locally. And so we did. And then we had reps, and I had a full-fledged business called Resting in the River. So it was, you know, over a 23-year period or whatever. So
it just kept going, kept moving. Now, did you sell that, or do you still do that?
No,
you sold it. Yeah.
I sold it in 2014 to a wonderful family. And they've kept it as a farm, which is real, I had hoped. And so it goes on.
It just keeps evolving. Wow.
And I packed everything up and came east and bought eight acres here and built another house. And here I am.
Wow. Like you mentioned race car driving.
Yeah.
Now, how did that all start? How did you get into race car driving?
Yeah, it was one of those things where I wasn't doing enough because I took a flight. I was going from, I guess, New York to L.A. Paul Newman was on the flight, and I knew him socially, he and Joanne. And so I said, oh, what are you doing, you know, coming to L.A.? And he said, oh, he was racing out at Riverside. It was going to be the last race. They were closing this racetrack. And I went, oh, I love racing, because when I was in high school, my best friend Jane's father bought a kind of run-down track in Missouri, and on Sundays we go to real early mass, and then we'd go out and we'd hand out the pit passes for all these guys who had funny cars and all the kind of, you know, quarter mile racing that they did then. And so I told Paul the thing, and he said, well, come on out. So that weekend I spent pretty much at the track with the guys. And so said to the manager, well, you know, where are you going next? And he said, Brainerd in Wisconsin. I said, could you, you know, get me an extra room at the motel or whatever with the crew? And so I traveled with them whenever I wasn't working for a year. And then Paul said to me, what have I wrought? He said, "What's going on? You go to school?" And I didn't even know they had schools. So I wound up at Bondurant's and Russell's and Skip Barber's. I took all the schools I could. And then I wound up, there were two tracks out in Palmdale because I was still part of the time in L.A. So I continued to race, and I raced for 7 years, had a whole team with a wonderful guy, Mike Lewis, who was a championship driver of Mazdas, and I liked the Mazda and the rotary engine. So anyway, so that's how that happened. So I made the Valvoline runoffs 4 times.
Wow.
It means you had to come in the top 4 of your division. So
that is so wild. Yeah. I mean, I love you. Like the engines, the Valvoline engines.
Yeah, I just loved it.
Wow.
And that time. And I met so many wonderful people I never would have met. And granted, the guys were not always, you know, the most welcoming. They were a little skittish. But, you know, I stayed out of their way. I just did my thing, brought the car home, just kept getting better, and eventually started to pass them, and then it was okay.
You know, you have the ability to kind of pivot and follow a path, but you also kind of know when that path is, you follow it through to maybe not the end, but when it's time to change again.
Yeah.
What is that? How do you know, like, okay, I've done the organic farm and now I kind of want to move back. I've, you know, raced cars. Now I kind of want to pivot. Is there some signal you get from the universe saying, okay, it's time to try something new?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of it is practical. For example, after a while, it was really tough to try to run the farm. And I made that big financial commitment. And do the racing, which is also a big financial commitment. So there, you know, I had to really take a look at that. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to live here and I'm going to work this farm, and I really was loving what I was doing and I was learning a lot and it was engaging me, I thought, you know, I'm never going to go any further in racing. Do you know what I mean? Other
yes.
than, you know, get better, of course, but that's it. So, and after a while, you have to take a look at your age. You know your reflexes are going to slow down a little bit, and you do need them. Paul drove until he was in his late 70s, and he was mm-hmm. phenomenal. But anyway, so I had to make a decision about the farm and the cost of things. And then
right.
come 2014, it took me, I would say, about 4 years to try and sell the farm
mm-hmm.
because it, too, was part and parcel of, well, how much further can I go? I'd have to truly leave the business in order to take the whole farm business to a new level. I was way ahead of the curve as far as organics were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And I was constantly having to change the formula to meet, the NOP. But I got to be the chairperson of the New Mexico Organic Commodities Commission. And we rewrote the statutes for the state in terms of organics and stuff like that. So I had all that wealth of experience. And I had started directing in the 80s, but I had left it. And I think all the 20-some-odd years at the farm really gave me the patience and the experience to go back to directing again in a completely different way than I would have in the 80s. And so that, you know, was something that intrigued me. And I suppose it's my interest. It's whatever kind of catches my interest, which sometimes is a great thing and sometimes it isn't, because sometimes you should focus and go in one path, but that doesn't seem the same.
Well,
I don't know. I'm hoping that I'm staying focused now.
Right.
Because I have to, you know what I mean? I'm forgetting names, so I have to get focused.
Well, yeah, we can relate to that, definitely.
I can do that, yes.
How had Hollywood changed when you went back in 2014? Did you see a more positive representation?
Yeah, it's a completely different business. It's like night and day from the 70s. In fact, they started calling the 70s the golden years. And the big thing was you had an awful lot of young men and to some extent women who didn't, you know, their history of filmmaking was negligible. And it was a completely different business. It was now run by big corporations. It was no longer a studio per se. It was just the arm of a much larger thing like Gulf and Western. Paramount was Gulf and Western and stuff like
wow.
that. And then the costs, the kinds of movies. It turned out that an independent film could be done, you know, on a very small budget, or you could, and you were guaranteed to make some money, so you picked up those independent films, or you had to have your top 10 people who could open a film at the box office, but those were costing $100 million and more to do and to earn money back. And so that middle section of 25, 50 million, you know, whatever, they didn't know for sure if they could make money on that film. So that film no longer got made. So it's been a whole complete shift of financial and creative thing. And then you have technology all of a sudden coming in, you know, and the move to digital and all of that just continuing to open up. And then thank God for cable, because mm-hmm. people would never have known my films if it weren't for cable.
Mm-hmm.
I think my films were one of the first that went to cable, and people, I suddenly had a whole new generation of fans, which was great. I mean, to this day, Drop Dead Fred is like a cult.
That's true.
I'm working, I'm helping write the book for the musical of Drop Dead
Fred. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, along with Tony Fingleton. And you know, and we have Australia's interested, so I don't know.
Wow.
We'll see what happens.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, that'll be so cool. That it would be. My daughter would love it. You know, she didn't. She missed that. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Just to touch back on the organic farm, were any of the products helpful in, because that was probably around the time where you were going through menopause and change of life and all that fun stuff. Were any of the products helpful with that?
No. The only thing, we had a wonderful tincture that was really cool because I had written a book and published by Simon & Schuster in 2000, and I went on a book tour, and I was going to be very nervous about it, and I said to this master herbalist who made all our products down in Albuquerque, I said, can you give me something, you know, that won't make me sleepy, but will just kind of chill me out? And I did find, and I called it the chill factor, and I used it for that. But I began to notice that it did keep the, you know, the hot flashes and down.
But, cool.
Yeah, so it kept it down. But mostly, you know, I was, you know, just part and parcel of that early curve that we just didn't know, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I remember yams were the big thing, and then you know, yam cream and eating yams and all kinds.
Really?
Oh wow.
We always like to ask that question.
I mean, no, I was
the yams didn't help.
I didn't have a really tough time compared to other people.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't affect me too much emotionally. I think probably because I'm already, you know, highly emotional anyway. So it didn't seem like it was that much more
different.
Yeah, but I do, you know, I can sympathize with
With that. Now, do you teach classes as well?
Yeah.
Or you are. So where are you? What do you do? Where do you teach?
I'm just teaching a small acting class for the Herbert Bergdorf Studios, HB Studios in New York City. But we're on Zoom right now. And one of my students is in Istanbul.
Another, oh, wow.
Yeah. And one is in Toronto and one is in Philadelphia or Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, and that's so cool with Zoom. That's so cool with Zoom that they can do that from there, because that, you know, it's changed. They can't, it was that you had to be in that city where they were having the classes. So that's great that it can reach so many people. Although I do miss seeing people.
I know, actually seeing them.
Yeah.
Awful. It is.
It is scary on me too.
I got to admit.
Yes.
It's terrible.
It is.
Yeah. I get my second shot this week.
So. Oh, good.
Yay. Okay.
Oh, good. Well, hopefully soon.
Tennessee, it'll be,
who knows?
We're like summer before we get.
Yeah. Oh,
well,
yeah.
No. Sure.
Yeah.
We're hoping. My daughter's wedding in September, so we're hoping that.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Down to the wire for that. But
yeah, we'll all have Band-Aids on.
Right? Big masks.
Yes.
When the pandemic is over and hopefully life goes to some semblance of normalcy, what would you like to see your next chapter kind of go into?
I would really like to see the Drop Dead Fred. And I've been working on another project, a play by the same author, Tony Fingleton. It was a film in Australia with Jeffrey Rush and Judy Davis called Swimming Upstream. And the producers said to him, you really ought to think about it as a play. So he came to me and asked me if I'd work on it with him to turn this screenplay into a proper play. And but it's all around these two young boys in the 50s who are competing for the Australian Olympics in swimming. So the whole crux of the challenge is, how do you portray swimming without water? So we started thinking outside the box, and a couple of years ago, I went to Montreal, and I worked with a fabulous group of acrobats. And we filmed it, a little piece of the, you know, the what the sort of play involves, along with a couple of Canadian actors and stuff. And I think we can actually accomplish it. So wow. I think it could be a really wonderful theatrical event to do this play with these acrobats integrated totally into the story. So we'll see.
Ooh, it kind of reminds me of like Cirque du Soleil.
Really integrate them. Really
integrate it into
The forward thrust of the whole play. So that's
Goodness.
Yeah,
that is. There's a girl from my hometown of Shelbyville, Kentucky, and she was in a Broadway play. Her name's Ruby Lewis, and she did Paramore. In New York, so I went to see her there, and they did.
I saw it.
Yeah, she was. What was the girl's name? I can't remember her name. The lead, but that was her. That's the girls from my hometown.
Wonderful.
She was so good,
She was great.
Oh, yeah. Send her. She's
oh my gosh!
Facebook.
You just made her entire year. If you tell her, Marsha Mason said she was.
She was great.
You're always thinking outside the box. I mean, that seems to be the story of your life, that you're a lifelong learner and a creator. And that's such a gift. It really is.
It is.
And you share it with all of us and the world when you create.
No, it isn't really that unique. I think everybody has that potential. I think what happens is that people get too scared or they're insecure. And they have to do what they fear the most. Fortunately, somebody told me that early on when I was in school. I had a nun who said that to me. We were rehearsing a play, and I had a moment where I just got really scared, and I said I couldn't do it, whatever the business was. And she took me aside and she said, no, you know, that's not true. And you have to do the things that scare you. Otherwise, you know, you do have a less, I think, expansive experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's great. Yeah, that you're not squashed down. That's great. Yes.
Anyway.
Yeah.
We want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. It has been an absolute honor to speak with you. And please come back anytime, especially to share anytime. Your new adventures.
Yes.
But thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Oh, great.
Good.
We're so glad you enjoyed it because we had a blast. We hope you guys enjoyed that conversation as much as we did. And we certainly did, right, Bridget?
Oh, my gosh. It was great. And, you know, she had said she had been feeling down before the interview and then she felt good because we're in the middle of an ice storm right now. She had like all this snow, like a foot of 2 feet
of
snow
or something.
So she had all the snow out. So it was so nice to talk to someone that is so inspiring and tries so many things that it's making my day feel better. Like, I am not going to just sit around today. I've got things I need to do today. And I just felt inspired to do them than to just let this weather get to me.
It was a great way to start the day. Really was.
Yes, absolutely.
Guys, if you're enjoying these conversations, which Bridget and I know you are, please make sure to press that little subscribe button. You'll see it. It's a little red button, subscribe. And that way you don't miss a single episode because you never know what's going to come up on Hot Flashes and Cool Topics. Sometimes we don't even know what's going to come up.
We don't even know. Something comes up. Something.
We're like, okay.
It's the day. And we're like, okay, are you ready? Let's go. You know,
do it.
We're not going anywhere. So
we have certainly learned a lot from this podcast and from every guest. And we hope you have done the same. So please subscribe. Please, if you have questions, email us at hotflashescooltopics@gmail.com. Join our Facebook group. Join our Twitter. Join our Instagram. Because we just are starting to put up really funny reels because we learned how to do them. And so Bridget and I are starting to put up ones with like music and all this different stuff. So check those out as well. That's Hot Flashes and Cool Topics on Instagram. Thank you so much, Marsha Mason, for being a guest on our show, for sharing your wisdom and your joy. And we can't wait to talk to the next person, right, Bridget?
That's right. Bye.
Have a great day, guys. Bye.